headlines. Iran's president says the increasing number of terrorist acts is in line with the United States' destabilizing strategy in Afghanistan. More Palestinian prisoners join hundreds of hunger-striking fellow inmates after Israel refused to accept their demand for improving jail's conditions. Plus, over 40 seismic tremors rattle Spain's La Palma Isle in a single day as the island has witnessed volcanic eruptions for almost a month. Our top story this hour, Iran's president says the increasing number of terrorist acts is in line with Washington's destabilizing strategy in Afghanistan. Ibrahim Raisi said the Afghan rulers are expected not to shirk responsibility for the care of their national security. He also stressed that the Islamic Republic is ready to cooperate with Afghanistan to provide stability and security for the nation. Last Friday, multiple bomb explosions ripped through a Shia mosque during the Friday prayers in the city of Kandahar, leaving more than 40 worshippers dead. In another attack, a week before, more than 50 Shia worshippers lost their lives in a Daesh-claimed bombing of a mosque in the northern city of Kunduz. Political commentator Layesh Sezdi says the U.S. is playing a significant role in destabilizing Afghanistan.
If the U.S., as there have been reports by Russia, which are possible, that they have been moving Daesh leaders, members of Daesh, from Syria, Iraq, to Afghanistan, northern Afghanistan, yes, Daesh there will be fulfilling an agenda to destabilize former Soviet Central Asia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, all the Muslim Sunni republics, you know, that once belonged to the Russian Tsarist Empire and later to the Soviet Union. But that doesn't mean that the Daesh have alone to, you know, be beholden to the Americans. They can, there in Afghanistan, do whatever they want if they are in league with the Taliban. Probably they're working for both. On the one hand, the idea to destabilize Central Asia and win more members, you know, for the organization and expand their criminal networks of drug trade and human trafficking, that would be fine, peachy king, like the Americans would say. But at the same time, if the Taliban can use them to murder Hazaras, everybody's happy. So maybe they are working for both.
Pakistanis have held a protest rally in the southern city of Karachi to condemn the latest terrorist attacks on two Shia mosques in neighboring Afghanistan. Muhammad Touri has more in this report.
Anger boiling on the streets of Karachi. People have come together to denounce the recent deadly attacks on two Shia mosques in the neighboring Afghanistan, Kunduz and Kandahar, that took the lives of over 100 worshippers. Protesters are outraged at what they call the global powers' failure in Afghanistan that led to the chaos and instability there. They say those powers are responsible for the recent bloodshed in the war-torn Afghanistan. Protesters chant anti-Israel and anti-US slogans and stress the need for unity among Muslims.
We were martyred in mosques, we were martyred on roads and processions, but we never backed off from our stance of following the footsteps of Hussein ibn Ali. It is the responsibility of Kabul government to provide security to Shia Muslims in Afghanistan. Otherwise, Taliban government can never get away with global criticism.
Fear looms large that the government in Kabul is unable to curb terrorist groups like Daesh terrorist group, who has claimed the attacks.
We are here to show solidarity with our brothers and sisters whose loved one became the victims of brutal terror attacks in Kunduz and Kandahar Shia mosques in last two Friday prayers. U.S. shameful withdrawal from Afghanistan brought us to this day, where our brothers and sisters are not safe.
Protesters also called on the Pakistani government to take up issue with the Afghan government. They said the international community should not remain silent towards the crimes being committed against Shia people of Afghanistan. Muhammad Touri, Karachi.
Israeli prison authorities have reportedly refused to stop harsh restriction against Palestinian inmates. That has led to more prisoners joining a hunger strike to protest against the tough conditions. We'll discuss the matter with our guests in the News Review program. Stick listening.
talks between Palestinian inmates and Israeli prison authorities over harsh conditions inside jails have reportedly collapsed. According to Palestinian media, the negotiations broke down due to the Israeli refusal to accept some of the prisoners' demands. The regime has been treating Palestinian prisoners harshly since last month, when six inmates escaped a heavily guarded Israeli jail. Over 400 Palestinians in Israeli prisons are on hunger strike in protest at punitive measures, with more joining them. The Islamic Jihad movement has warned that it will not shy away from going to war with the Israeli regime to defend the prisoners. Joining us is Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network from Vancouver. And we also have Henry Herskovitz, an anti-Israel peace activist from Ann Arbor. Welcome, Charlotte. If I could start with you. I mean, rights groups already say Palestinian prisoners experience harsh conditions in Israeli jails. Is any idea what additional punitive measures that Israel has imposed on these on Palestinian prisoners?
Certainly. After what's been called the Freedom Tunnel operation, that is six Palestinian prisoners who used, you know, every single tool that they could find at hand, from, you know, spoons to pens inside their cell, to dig a tunnel to freedom outside the heavily fortified Israeli colonial Gilboa prison, winning their freedom and obtaining the support and solidarity of Palestinians throughout Palestine and around the world and all people of conscience, and also really exposing the weakness of Israel's, you know, much touted and marketed security technologies. Since the six prisoners and their fellow brothers among the Islamic Jihad prisoners have been recaptured, they have been subjected to torture, isolation, harsh interrogation. They've been separated from one another. They've been repeatedly transferred from prison to prison. The six themselves were subject to harsh physical interrogation, torture, sleep deprivation, ongoing attacks to attempt to wear them down and break their will, which their will has refused to be broken. The Islamic Jihad prisoners in particular were basically deprived of all of the very limited rights, all of which have been obtained through decades of struggle among the Palestinian prisoners and among the Palestinian prisoners' movement, including hunger strikes, organized actions, and movement building inside the prison in cooperation with the Palestinian resistance outside prison. And so this attack on the Islamic Jihad prisoners, where there are now 250 on hunger strike to demand an end to these kinds of measures, isn't an attack on just this set of prisoners, but on all of the struggles throughout the past decades and decades of Palestinian prisoners organizing to have the ability to not be forced to labor or to stay with one another and with their comrades and brothers in their own political organizations. And so this is just one attempt after another, from cutting the supply of water to the prisons, to refusing to allow books into the prisons, to cutting off family visits, to cutting off legal visits. Israel's constantly engaged in a war against the Palestinian political prisoners, and Palestinian prisoners are engaged in constant resistance with their bodies and lives on the front lines every day confronting the jailers. And so this struggle that's taking place right now, it is really for the rights and dignity of all 4,650 Palestinian political prisoners inside Israeli jails.
Henry, do you see this harsh conditions that Israel has imposed on the Palestinian prisoners as a response to the it was quite an embarrassing prison break for the Israeli authorities? You had six Palestinians escaping essentially with a spoon from a heavily fortified Israeli prison. Is this a collective punishment by Israel? Do you see it as that?
Well, I certainly see it as a collective punishment. And to add, collective punishment is such a cruel punishment because it doesn't affect the people who are purportedly guilty. But the cruelty is just completely symbolic of the entire Jewish Zionist regime that has invaded Palestine for the last 80 years and continues on with the genocide of the Palestinian people. It would all be decried as a racist regime, and yet somehow, I think due to the manipulation and domination of our press media, that these concepts don't get out to the regular people. And to me, the cruelty is really magnified when they go after the families of the prisoners and punish the families. But again, the cruelty that is exemplified in these actions is just a reflection of the cruelty of an entire movement that would seek to invade and displace one people for another people.
Okay, I'm afraid time has gotten the better of us. Let me thank our guest, Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. They're joining us from Vancouver, and Henry Herskovitz, an anti-Israel peace activist from Ann Arbor. And David, thank you for staying tuned to another edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. Iraqis have taken to the streets across the nation to protest the results of last Sunday's parliamentary elections amid reports of voter fraud and irregularities. People called on officials to recount all the ballots or hold another election. They also pledged to keep up their rallies until their demands are met. Iraq's Electoral Commission began recounting the votes after some political parties contested the outcome. The initial vote tally has put influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's bloc in the lead with more than 70 seats in 329-member parliament. The final results should be certified by the federal court. Meanwhile, former Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki called on people to protest in a peaceful manner. The UN Special Envoy for Syria says Damascus and the opposition have agreed to draw up a new constitution. Geir Petersen said the co-chairs of the Syrian Constitutional Committee will discuss clear principles in their upcoming talks. Each side is expected to offer texts on matters including Syria's sovereignty and rule of law. The Syrian government and the opposition, as well as civil society, have so far held five rounds of talks over the past 2 years. The committee aims to find a solution to the years-long Syrian crisis. The new constitution would lead to UN-supervised elections. From the October 17 protests to Beirut blast is the title of a new documentary that reviews the nationwide protest in Lebanon in 2019 and the 2020 explosion in Beirut. The film has been premiered in Iran's capital, Tehran, with the attendance of the filmmaker, Youssef Chalabi, reports.
From the 2019 anti-government protests in Lebanon to the 2020 explosion in Beirut port, this documentary delves into the heart of the historic incidents to shed light on the truth. Directed by Lebanese filmmaker Sahar Hossein Ghaddar, the feature documentary was premiered in Tehran. Over the course of the filmmaking, Sahar attended the 2019 nationwide protests, which she says were sparked by economic mismanagement and corruption, but were wrongly portrayed to be against the resistance movement.
The 2019 demonstrations were born out of people's pain and hardship and sought to put an end to 3 decades of corruption entrenched in the ruling system in Lebanon. People from all walks of life, including supporters of the resistance movement, were among the protesters. But Israeli opportunists tried to hijack the protest and say that the demonstrations were triggered by anti-Hezbollah sentiments.
The documentary also reviews the August 2020 blast at the port of Beirut, which killed 219 people. No one has yet been charged in the 14-month probe into the incident. However, Hezbollah has been critical of Judge Tariq Bitar for weeks, accusing him of singling out Hezbollah-affiliated politicians for questioning over the explosion. Last week, 6 pro-Hezbollah protesters were shot dead by anonymous gunmen during a demonstration by resistance groups who called the investigation politicized and demanded the removal of Judge Bitar.
Israeli footprints can be traced in the case that investigates the Beirut explosion. Israel and the U.S. seize any chance to deal a blow to our country and the resistance axis. What Mr. Bitar is doing serves the interest of our Israeli and American enemies by trying in vain to implicate Hezbollah in the Beirut port blast. And we saw a few days ago that our peaceful protests against Bitar were faced by sniper bullets shot by a Lebanese forces faction from a Christian neighborhood.
Last year's port blast happened after a fire detonated nearly 3,000 tons of ammonium nitrate, a combustible chemical widely used as agricultural fertilizer that had been stored unsafely in a port warehouse for almost 6 years. Based on information provided in the documentary, senior Lebanese officials were aware of the material's existence and the danger it posed, but failed to secure, remove, or destroy it. The documentarian says her film tries to expose what she calls a string of lies that seeks to smear the resistance access. She says that string is pulled by Israel, stressing that she and her fellow Lebanese youth demand a strong government and judicial system that are independent of Israeli manipulation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, there's no end in sight to the volcanic eruption on Spain's La Palma Island about a month after it began spewing lava and forcing thousands of islanders to leave their homes. President of Spain's Canary Islands, Ángel Víctor Torres, says scientists monitoring the volcano have seen no indications that the eruption is abating. Addressing a press conference, he said islanders are at the mercy of the volcano as rivers of lava continue flowing slowly toward the sea. He added there were 42 tremors on the island on Sunday, with the largest one measuring 4.3 at Richter scale. The eruption that began on September the 19th has destroyed 2,000 buildings and over 700 hectares of land. The eruption has also disrupted flights from or to La Palma. About 7,000 residents have also been evacuated on the island.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border. We're prepared for you an article written jointly by Robert Reich and Edward Helmore. The piece is titled "American Guns Are Flooding into Mexico and Wreaking Havoc." The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Even as Republican members of U.S. Congress accuse President Joe Biden of failing to secure the nation's southern border, Mexico is facing a growing problem of securing its northern border. Guns from the United States are pouring into Mexico, arming violent drug gangs. Mexico has tried just about everything to stop the flow of firearms from the north, passing strict gun control laws, imposing stiff penalties on traffickers, and pleading with U.S. authorities to stop the trafficking. But nothing has worked. So now it's doing what any litigious American would do. It's suing. On Wednesday, 4th of August, Mexico announced that it is seeking at least $10 billion in compensation from 11 major U.S. gun manufacturers for the havoc the U.S. guns have wrought south of the border. The lawsuit charges America's gun makers know their products are being trafficked to Mexico and are expressly marketing their weapons to Mexican criminal gangs, designing guns to be easily modified to fire automatically, and be readily transferable on the criminal market in Mexico. The deluge of firearms from the United States to Mexico, on average more than 500 every day, is contributing to mayhem there. Killings have become a routine part of the Mexican drug trade. In Mexico's recent midterm election campaign, 30 candidates were gunned down by criminal gangs. In 2019 alone, at least 17,000 homicides in Mexico were linked to trafficked weapons. Yet Mexico's lawsuit is likely to face tough going in the United States, where the easy accessibility of guns is also wreaking havoc, but where gun ownership is considered a constitutional right and gun purchases are skyrocketing. In addition, U.S. gun makers have erected a fortress of legal protections. In 2005, the gun lobby got congressional Republicans to enact the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Firearms Act, banning most lawsuits brought against gun manufacturers from marketing and distributing their products. At a more basic level, American capitalism considers any market to be an opportunity to make a profit. After all, a buck is a buck, or more precisely, 19.98 pesos at today's exchange rate. In the United States, buying and selling are hallmarks of freedom. To prohibit a sale is to intrude on the free market. For another government to bar its consumers from buying American goods is to violate free trade. Alejandro Celorio, a legal advisor to Mexico's foreign ministry, estimates the damage to the Mexican economy caused by trafficked guns totals 1.7% to 2% of Mexico's gross domestic product, GDP. What's left unsaid is that Mexico's illicit drug business is also a boon to the Mexican economy, adding billions of dollars each year in foreign sales, mostly to American consumers eager to buy thousands of kilos of methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl each year. Freedom of contract, it's called. We sell them guns that kill them. They sell us drugs that kill us. But this isn't trading goods. It's trading bads. There's death on both sides. The merchants of such death, American gun makers like Glock, Smith & Wesson, Beretta USA, Barrett, Century International Arms, and Colt, Mexican producers of methamphetamines, heroin, and fentanyl, and the wholesalers and traffickers connecting buyers with sellers on both sides of the border are making piles of money. Free market ideologues will argue that as long as everyone is getting what they want, these trades are efficient. Yet vast numbers of people are dying. The U.S. Republicans who protect gun manufacturers and who are criticizing President Joe Biden for failing to secure the southern border from migrants desperate to come to the United States should take note of this tragic irony. The flood of guns from the United States into Mexico is helping to sustain much of the crime, violence, and corruption, driving thousands of Mexicans to seek a better life north of the border in the United States. It's also enabling the flow of dangerous drugs from Mexico across the border that are killing hundreds of thousands of Americans, many in states and congressional districts represented by those same Republicans. Guns, dangerous drugs, and desperate migrants are inextricably connected. The answer to solving one of these problems lies in responding to all three. Moreover, gun sales, which spiked sharply during the early months of the coronavirus pandemic, have continued to increase in the United States, with first-time buyers making up more than one-fifth of Americans who purchase guns. The development will frustrate and disappoint gun control advocates who point out the huge number of firearms already circulating in American society, as well as a seemingly never-ending cycle of mass shootings. A study by the General Social Survey, a public opinion poll conducted by a research center at the University of Chicago, 39% of American households own guns, up from 32% in 2016. Separately, research data compiled by the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS, background checks that topped 1 million a week in March of 2020, the highest since the government began tracking them in 1998, and continued with 1 week in April this year recording a record 1.2 million checks. Background checks are seen as a reliable metric to track gun sales. A third data study, compiled by Northeastern University and the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and seen by the New York Times, shows that 6.5% of American adults, or 17 million people in the United States, have purchased guns in the past year, up from 5.3% in 2019. Of those, almost one-fifth who bought guns last year were first-time gun owners, of whom half were women, a fifth were black, and a fifth were Hispanic. In 2021, gun owners overall were 63% male, 73% were white, 10% were black, and 12% were Hispanic. Separately, the Thrace, a nonpartisan group that tracks gun sales, estimates that 2.3 million guns were purchased in January of this year alone. The group said sales, which had remained largely flat for the duration of the Trump presidency, jumped 64% in 2020. Still, the increases are relatively small compared to the 400 million guns estimated to already be in circulation, including at least 4 million AR-15s, commonly described as assault rifles. South Los Angeles City Council representative Marquise Harris-Dawson told the New York Times, "Americans are in an arms race with themselves," adding, "There was just as much a run on guns as on detergents and cleaners in the beginning of the pandemic." Increased gun sales comes as Texas recently became the 20th state to pass legislation that no longer requires a permit to carry a concealed handgun. At the same time, a rash of mass shootings, often involving AR-15 weapons, have dominated headlines. According to the Gun Violence Archive, 67 mass shootings have taken place in May of this year. The most recent occurred when a gunman opened fire in Miami, Florida, killing two people and injuring 20 others. Authorities in Texas said recently they had arrested a man accused of plotting to carry out a mass shooting at a Walmart store, and a search of the suspect's home turned up firearms, ammunition, and materials officials described as radical ideology paraphernalia. Still, researchers are wary of connecting increased gun ownership with gun violence. The FBI reported a 25% rise in homicides last year that has continued into this, with an 18% increase over the first 3 months of 2021 across 37 cities, including rises of 36% in the city of Los Angeles and 23% in New York City. But criminologist Richard Rosenfeld at the University of Missouri told the New York Times that the focus on gun numbers is misplaced. Richard Rosenfeld said, "The critical issue is not simply the increase in the supply of guns, but in the nature of the weaponry that's being used in violent crime. And that has really changed."
for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and we congratulate you all on the blessed 10th of the month of Rabiul Awal, the wedding anniversary of the Prophet of Islam and the virtuous lady Hazrat Khadija al-Kubra, peace be upon them. Here is a famous saying from the Holy Prophet in memory of the First Lady of Islam, who was his only wife for 25 long years. By God, the Almighty did not grant me a better wife than her. She believed in me when people used to mock at me, and she acknowledged me when people denied me. She shared her wealth and property with me, and she bore me children which I was not destined to have through other women.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Piety Opens All Doors. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Sometimes in life, all doors are closed. All these doors are closed to a man, and whenever he turns and wherever he turns, he finds himself surrounded by problems and difficulties. Such events, in fact, present an opportunity. You know, we see these things to be of detriment. These are the things that we don't like to see in our lives. But honestly, all of these things are, they have a beauty. They carry a beauty. All of these things are an opportunity. They are a wake-up call, reminding a person of realities of life and coaxing him to change direction, take corrective actions, and return to the right path prescribed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. At this time, if he reverts, if he, you know, turns back, what happens? If he turns back to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he reverts to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with sincerity and full concentration and seeks assistance from his pure essence, divine assistance shall be given to him. Breezes of Allah's mercy would embrace him, and the closed doors would be opened in wonderful ways. Imam Taqi alayhi salam has said, "If the doors of heavens and earth are closed to someone, and he then adopts piety, God shall provide relief to him." See, if you notice, Imam is talking about the doors of this earth as well, not just the hereafter, not just the heavens. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing Piety Opens All Doors. And we said that, you know, according to the teachings of Islam, if all doors are closed and shut down for a believer, for somebody who is a believer in Allah, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt, and all doors of heavens are even shut down for him, but he does see it as an opportunity, and that feeling of it being opportunity compels him to change his direction and he adopts taqwa of Allah. He adopts God consciousness. He adopts piety. Allah will open up these doors that are already shut down for him. The doors of heaven and the doors of earth. So he is going to make this life and the hereafter, both of them, easier for him. Brothers and sisters, the condition is adopting piety. A known and a decision that he voluntarily makes. Allah gives him a helping hand. His reliance on other than Allah stops, because now he's dependent on Allah. He has adopted the taqwa of Allah and God consciousness and piety. So this is what makes his journey from there on easier. And this is a phenomena that if we let it sink in, we prepare ourselves to take this route, we start seeing miracles in our lives. After every difficulty, there is comfort promised by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Materials and methods are vital for an artist who combines them to create a masterpiece. Well, a Brazilian artist has used an unusual material to create a huge, dazzling artwork. Mondano has drawn a mural measuring 1,000 square meters using ashes from the burnt Amazon rainforest. The artwork on the side of a building in the city of Sao Paulo depicts a firefighter standing near the scenes of deforestation, blazes, and dead animals. Mondano says he traveled extensively to feel that sadness and, more importantly, to collect ashes for his paintings. He says his aim is to call attention to the environment in his home country, where thousands of wildfires break out each year.
Be the first to cast a balloon. That's what competitors played to win the title at the first Balloon World Cup in Spain. The competition was held in an amusement park in the northeastern city of Tarragona. Participants had to get the balloon to touch the ground before their opponent could touch it. The event was organized by FC Barcelona player Gerard Piqué and a famous web streamer and commentator.
Get out of your comfort zone and try new things. Today we are very proud to have tried something like that, and that it has worked so well, and that people have enjoyed it. In the end, it's about people having a great time.
The competition was inspired by a trio of American siblings whose balloon game videos had attracted millions of views on TikTok and Instagram. 32 countries competed for the title, and 18-year-old teenager from Peru became the first world champion of this tournament. He defeated his German rival in a 5-minute final match. For those of you with an extreme fear of needles, this may finally be the good news. A group of Dutch researchers say they are working to create painless needle-free injections. The researchers have developed what they call a bubble gun. The device uses a laser to push tiny droplets through the skin. Take a listen to David Fernandez Rivas, the head of the project, explaining how the process is done within a millisecond.
So within a millisecond, the glass that contains the liquid is heated by a laser. A bubble is created in the liquid, pushing the liquid at velocities on the order of 100 kilometers per hour. And we can see the gelatin, how it penetrates about 1 millimeter approximately.
Now, Riva says the invention will help ease fear of needles and lower the threshold for vaccinations. He believes the new technology can also prevent the risk of contamination through needles and reduce medical waste. If you're eager to get a needle-free shot, you may still have to wait a few more years before they are made available to everyone. From a voyage aboard a fictional spacecraft to a real-life journey to space, a 90-year-old Canadian actor known for his portrayal of a starship captain for decades is now the oldest person ever going to space. After a couple of days of training, William Shatner hitched a ride aboard a suborbital spacecraft on Wednesday. He took off from a Texas desert as a guest alongside three other passengers, two professionals, and a paid customer. During the 10-minute flight, the team experienced more than 3 minutes of weightlessness. Now, listen to the actor describing the voyage as the most unbelievable experience of his life.
I'm so filled with emotion about what just happened. It's extraordinary. I hope I never recover from this. I hope that I can maintain what I feel now. I don't want to lose it.
During a televised journey, the capsule took its four passengers above the maximum altitude of 100 kilometers, a point where the curvatures of the Earth can be seen. With that, the space captain of the entertainment world also broke a record as the oldest space traveler. Now, many see his experience as the embodiment of the space travel promises he made through decades of acting. The population of giant pandas in captivity has reached a record high of 673 in 2021. Official data shows this year 48 panda cubs were born, of which 46 survived. Meanwhile, the total number of overseas giant pandas has reached 69. This is the result of joint efforts by Chinese and foreign researchers following decades of caring for the lovely animals. In July, another study put the number of giant pandas living in the wild at over 1,800. The cute bears were then reclassified from endangered to vulnerable. Experts believe such research improves conservation efforts and facilitates monitoring of animal populations. With the help of artificial intelligence, Beethoven's 10th and last symphony is now completed. A group of German musicologists and programmers started the project over a year ago. They analyzed Beethoven's style and then used algorithms to teach a computer to complete the unfinished job. The work was released to mark the 250th anniversary of the prominent musician's birth. The team said they tried hard to solve the puzzle while remaining faithful to Beethoven's process and vision.
I believe that if a composer like Ludwig van Beethoven were to live today, he would probably not only have a large technology team around him to help him, but he would push exactly such technologies and use them for his art. And for me, art is not something that stands fixed in space and is always the same, but that changes with the world, and we can witness that today.
When the German composer died in 1827, he left behind some musical sketches for his 10th symphony. Some experts tried to complete it in the past, but they did not succeed. Researchers in the United States have created an incredibly versatile robot named Leonardo or Leo. Leo was developed by a team at the California Institute of Technology's Center for Autonomous Systems and Technologies. The futuristic robot can walk a tightrope, skateboard, and even fly. Its uniqueness lies in the fact that it uses not just one, but two modes of locomotion. The researchers who developed Leo believe that similar robots will be employed on a wider scale in the future.
I think we're going to see robots like Leonardo with these extraordinary locomotion capabilities be used in things like space exploration, because they can overcome very difficult terrain, they can reach hard-to-reach places. But then I think also robots will be more and more in our daily lives. As these robots become more and more robust, more and more reliable, we're going to see them for things like package delivery or helping in the house with daily chores.
Leo is 75 centimeters tall and has four propeller thrusters mounted on its shoulders. While walking, it mimics the movements of a human by using those propellers and a pair of actuated legs. The robot can transition smoothly between flying and walking. Leonardo perceives the world around it with the help of cameras and sensors.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Hot air balloons were invented in the 18th century, enabling man to finally fulfill his dream of flying. After more than 200 years, people are still eager to ride the colorful vehicles. Some even use them competitively. In the German Hot Air Ballooning Championships, balloonists will fly over the skies of the green Bavarian town of Tegernsee. 25 of Germany's best pilots are vying for first place. The organizers of the event expect a tight race, as the contestants have all managed to pass the previous competitions with flying colors to qualify for the national championship.
A zoo in northeast France has an adorable new inhabitant, a white baby rhinoceros. The cute little male rhino was born on the 6th of October. The zoo staff have given him the name of Mole. He was able to withstand less than 2 hours after being born. Mole soon started feeding from his gentle 21-year-old mother called Tala. Mole is Tala's third baby.
Children and young adults have once again come back to cinema as Iran is hosting the 34th edition of the International Film Festival for Children and Youth. Salman Kujuri has the story.
The 34th edition of the International Film Festival for Children and the Youth is underway in Iran, with around 600 films from 32 countries having entered the contest. The motto of this year's festival is Cinema, the Land of Imagination. In the national section, some 440 films from Iranian movie makers have been submitted to the secretariat of the festival, including 248 short, 119 short animated, 30 feature-length and 14 feature films, 12 web series, and also 19 current narrations.
This edition of the festival can be considered as a festival of cinema products for the most important generation of the next century. A generation that must redefine the country in the new world and protects its power, culture, pride, and identity. Although the tragedy of the pandemic is terrible, at least it assures us that the next generation, from an early age, has experienced and learned to deal with difficult circumstances and pay due attention to the importance of cooperation and teamwork in the face of major crises.
The foreign films include 32 animated and 30 feature-length movies from 32 countries, as well as 56 short movies, including 21 short animated and 35 short feature films. The movies have been screened in two cities, Tehran and Isfahan, both in an online format and in theaters in compliance with the health protocols.
I've narrated a couple of films at this festival, and I love to watch children's films. I love comedy. I watched a number of movies at this festival, and they've been good.
This year, I have taken part in this edition of the festival with a film for which my colleagues and I have tried so hard to produce. I care about the children of my country because they are future makers of this land. I hope children will like my movie.
Such platforms as Harshur, Tiva and Filima have displayed the films, and the online audience can watch the works on these free online platforms.
Children's movies are an excellent way to educate them. They can be very useful to teach them history, show them different cultures, accustom them to fundamental values, and show them how to think, all in a simple and entertaining way. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Australian scientists have developed artificial structures that act as a much-needed habitat for marine life.
It's extremely exciting because we have seen a total of more than 90 species colonizing these diverse panels. And we see 30 to 40% more species on the panels in the living seawalls than on the unmodified parts of the seawall, so the seawalls with no panels. So that's extremely exciting and really gives us confidence to scale this up to other environments and other artificial structures.
The project has installed over 1,000 artificially designed panels onto seawalls in Sydney. These craggy concrete panels are 3D printed and designed to last for at least 20 years. Only a short time after installation, they turned into a cozy new home for the fish, crustaceans, and other marine life.
So we have more fish in Sydney Harbour than we have in the entire UK coast. So we have more than 500 species of fish in the harbour, so that's quite impressive. But what we notice is that urbanization and the human settling, especially towards the coast, has a lot of impacts on this amazing marine environment, and that's what we are trying to mitigate a bit with the living seawalls by attaching these panels that mimic natural features such as rocky shores and rock pools and crevices and nooks and crannies.
After becoming popular in Australia, the panels were also installed in Wales and Singapore. The scientists say since the installation of these panels, the quality of Sydney's harbour water has improved. They hope coastal structures built in the future would be ecologically sustainable, designed not only for humans, but for nature.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
United Nations Human Rights Council action silences Yemeni victims of human rights abuses. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Katy Kelly, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Did the United Nations Just Abandon Yemen? Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Monday, October 11th, marked the official closure of the UN Group of Eminent Experts on Yemen, also known as the Group of Experts for GEE. For nearly 4 years, this investigative group examined alleged human rights abuses suffered by Yemenis whose basic rights to food, shelter, safety, healthcare, and education were horribly violated, all while they were bludgeoned by Saudi and U.S. airstrikes, drone attacks, and constant warfare since 2014. The GEE wrote in a statement the day after the UN Human Rights Council refused to extend a mandate for continuation of the group's work. This is a major setback for all victims who have suffered serious violations during the armed conflict. The council appears to be abandoning the people of Yemen, the statement says, adding that victims of this tragic armed conflict should not be silenced by the decision of a few states. Prior to the vote, there were indications that Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as Bahrain, which sits on the UN Human Rights Council, had increased lobbying efforts worldwide in a bid to do away with the group of experts. Actions of the Saudi-led coalition waging war against Yemen had been examined and reported on by the group of experts. Last year, the Saudi bid for a seat on the Human Rights Council was rejected, but Bahrain serves as its proxy. Bahrain is a notorious human rights violator and a staunch member of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia-led coalition, which buys billions of dollars worth of weaponry from the U.S. regime and other countries to bomb Yemen's infrastructure, kill civilians, and displace millions of people. The group of experts was mandated to investigate violations committed by all warring parties. The group of experts' mission has come to an end, but the fear and intimidation faced by Yemeni victims and witnesses continues. Watana for Human Rights, an independent Yemeni organization established in 2007, advocates for human rights by reporting on issues such as the torture of detainees, grossly unfair trials, patterns of injustice, and starvation by warfare through the destruction of farms and water sources. M. Watana had hoped the UN Human Rights Council would grant the group of experts a multi-year extension. Members of N. Watana fear their voice will be silenced within the United Nations if the Human Rights Council's decision is an indicator of how much the Council cares about Yemenis. The GEE is the only independent and impartial mechanism working to deter war crimes and other violations by all parties to the conflict, said Radia Al-Mutawakkil, chairperson of M. Watana for Human Rights. She believes that doing away with this body will give a green light to continue violations that condemn millions in Yemen to unremitting violence, death, and constant fear. The Yemen Data Project, founded in 2016, is an independent entity aiming to collect data on the conduct of the war in Yemen. Their most recent monthly report tallied the number of air raids in September, which had risen to the highest monthly rate since March. Sirwa, a district in Mareb province,